You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405 on this beautiful sunshiny day in Southern California. We have a very intriguing guest today, Ted Morocco, the founder and CEO of Silent, a cybersecurity company in Los Angeles. So, Ted, welcome to the Pilgrim on the 405.
Hey, Will, it's great to be here. I have been listening to your podcast for a while now. I'm really enjoying it. Don't have the same commute that I've had in the past because, unfortunately, we're still working from home. Hoping to get back out on that 405 in the not too distant future, and enjoying the companies that you're bringing visibility to here in our in the Southland.
Well, great. So tell us a little bit about Silent. What does Silent do?
Okay. Well, Silent is really about protecting intellectual property. And I think it's very relevant, your audience here, because Southern California does have such a creative community. And I think a lot of people hear the term piracy bantered around a lot, particularly because we see a lot of it, you know, in the film industry and with the music industry. And that's not what we do, but we are focused on a different piece of piracy, which is focused more on the software angle. So I think a lot of people know that not all software out there is genuine. There's a lot of counterfeit licenses and counterfeit products that are out there. We're specifically focused on the business to business side of software. And we work with some of the largest software companies in the world to try to protect their valuable intellectual property from piracy. And these are the kind of tools that are used in critical industries like the defense industry, semiconductor industry, automotive industry. A lot of it is involved in engineering type applications, but our technology is broadly applicable. And we're kind of on the forefront of basically trying to help customers identify who's using their intellectual property without proper licensing and helping them recover that revenue that's being lost, you know, every day. And sadly, a lot of the, piracy is a global problem. But one of the things that I think we'll talk about a little bit today is the particular challenges with China. You know, China's one of the worst offenders when it comes to IP. They're certainly not exclusive. We have offenders all over the world, but one of the things we'll probably get into, you know, today.
Well, all right. So your technology will protect software, and you use the word IP as well as software. So is there other areas that you can help folks with?
I kind of talk about software and intellectual property interchangeably. There are also ways, you know, we basically develop telemetry tools, and those telemetry tools get embedded into applications, and in this case, software applications. But we've developed some new technology to try to identify more file-based intellectual property. And that could be more broadly applicable to, you know, one of the areas that we're particularly interested in is semiconductor IP. A lot of talk about the semiconductor industry, it is all basically, you know, bits and bytes these days. You know, the semiconductor designs are developed with these CAD tools, and then they can be very easily exfiltrated from the people who are developing them and reused without licensing. So that's another thing that we're tracking.
So I can appreciate how you would track and prevent piracy, or at least alert people to piracy from software. But semiconductors, you talk about the design then, is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. We're going to be able to track the design. We're not going to be able to track the chip itself. So a lot of these chips end up being manufactured in Taiwan at some of the big fabs in Taiwan. But those fabs are using electronic design files to produce the chips. And those electronic design files can contain things like watermarks to try to identify who was the creator of that IP. And is that IP being manufactured with the proper licensing? That's one of the things that we're very focused on and very interested in. But more basic to that is the design tools that are used to create the chip design. It takes very sophisticated software to develop these chips. And my first startup here in Southern California was actually a company that did electronic design automation software. And our EDA tools were being pirated, widely pirated all over the world, but especially in the Asia Pacific region. And we had no way of fighting that. We had no way of, you know, I would go to board meetings and our investors would ask, they'd say, "Hey, Ted, how much of your software is pirated?" And we had no idea. We couldn't measure it. All we could say is a lot. And we looked for solutions to this problem, and there was nothing available. You know, the company that was developing our license manager, they kept claiming that the next release would make it more secure and they'd be able to protect our technology. But inevitably we would find on the internet that within days of a new release going out, there would be another cracked version out on the internet. And people had pre-access to an application that we had lots of PhDs working, you know, weekends and long hours developing this technology. And we had legitimate customers that were paying, investing in this technology. And then we had a lot of people that were just using it for free. We finally decided that nobody was going to solve this problem for us, and our engineers had to solve the problem. So we developed our own in-house reporting mechanism. We just called it affectionately "Phone Home," based on ET.
Right.
And we had the software. We put a feature in it to check for updates. But we also, in addition to checking to see if there was a new update or a new patch for the software, when it phoned home, it reported a serial number so that we could tell who the licensee was. And I'll never forget the board meeting that I showed up with. We had one board member who kept asking, you know, "Well, how many people are using pirated copies?" And we always said that we don't know. So finally, I showed up at that board meeting, and they're like, so Ted, can you tell me, you know, how many people are using pirated copies?" And I said, 60%. And the board member said, what? I didn't hear that. Did you say 6%? And I said, "No, I said 60%. He says, "I didn't hear you. Did you say 16%? I said, "No, 60%. You know, so it was 60%. 6 out of every 10 users of this very sophisticated design tool for designing, and this is used to design chips that would go into electronic warfare products, into, you know, guidance and control systems, into cell phones, and into satellite communication systems. So used very extensively throughout the industry for communications and for defense electronics. 60%, 6 out of 10 users was using a counterfeit license. And guess where most of them were?
Must be China.
Well, yeah, China, we had a over 99% piracy rate. Our friends in Russia, 98%, you know, piracy rate. But it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just our military adversaries that were using, you know, crack licenses. We had 70% piracy in Taiwan, similar in Korea. Parts of Europe, we had extensive piracy, particularly Southern Europe, you know, Italy and Spain, and Greece and Turkey. We were experiencing, you know, close to 50% or 50% and more. The United States was not completely innocent. Believe me, there, you know, I think we were over 25-30% in the U.S. And parts of Western Europe. So we had all of this data start coming in, and we were trying to figure out, well, what do we do with this? How do we, how do we, you know, and again, we didn't know what we were doing. We weren't lawyers. The first mistake I think we made was we filed a lawsuit against one of our, we noticed that also in addition to, the users of our tools, all of our competitors were using counterfeit licenses. So they were trying to catch up with us. They were trying to reverse engineer some of the tips and tricks that we were particularly good at. And that all came to light with this phone home technology. And that was, you know, that was a long time ago, but to this, so that was the inspiration. That was really kind of something we developed at my first company. And the mistakes we made in the beginning were numerous. We filed some lawsuits without really understanding fully copyright law or data privacy or, you know, some of the other things that were imperative. We learned some lessons along the way, but ultimately we were able to start to get these infringers to, not only purchase licenses, but to become really valuable customers. So it wasn't an acrimonious, a lot of these conversations were not acrimonious. You know, some of them were, but in a lot of cases, when you bring this piracy situation, especially to the attention of senior management, they would have employees in their organization that had downloaded and installed these illegal versions on their network, and they were unaware of it. So they were like, thank you for bringing this to our attention. This is a vulnerability. This is a network vulnerability and a legal liability that you have brought to our attention, and you've solved it for us. So we created valuable customer relationships when we started to have those conversations, and we did get to the very top of the decision-making authorities in some of these companies. So it was really the gift that kept on giving. You know, this data gave us huge market intelligence and insights into what was going on, and it allowed us to solve problems. So
it's interesting. Would you say that the problems, that some of the problems were solved by moral suasion rather than a legal imposition?
I would say that emphatically. I would say that at least 9 out of 10 was solved through what ended up being a constructive discussion amongst business leaders and executives at both companies. Maybe 1 out of 10 ended up in with more serious, I'm not saying 1 out of 10 ended up in litigation, because I think over 10 years, I think we litigated 4 times in 10 years. And most of that was just to establish precedent that the letters that we were sending out were not paper tigers, that we did need business and that we did have a legal standing. But, you know, if you're an executive, let's say you're the vice president of engineering at a semiconductor company, and you receive this letter, and you go and you talk to your engineers and you do your own investigation and you discover that they are in fact using counterfeit software. Maybe they knew about it, maybe they didn't know about it, but you certainly want to get a legal release. You don't want to destroy the evidence. You don't want to do anything illegal, because that's, you know, then you're going from, you know, an accidental copyright infringement to, you know, kind of a criminal situation where you start to, you know, destroy evidence. Now, I do believe in other parts of the world, you know, there is the destruction of evidence. I do believe that a number of computers that we listed as having counterfeit licenses ended up in the South China Sea, probably used them to build those islands. Most of the time you end up really having a constructive conversation. And at the end of the day, you end up shaking hands with the people and putting in place a long corporate agreement and a broad licensing arrangement with the customer. And they tell you that, you know, up front, they're like, hey, if you see anything suspicious, don't wait. Come to me personally. Let me know. I will fix it. I will make sure that we are using, you know, we have most of these companies on their websites. They have these policies that say we respect intellectual property. We create intellectual property and we respect intellectual property. The last thing they want to be doing is using a illegal counterfeit piece of software. And then you get into all the cyber risks, the malware risks that come along with that counterfeit.
Did you find that kind of reception when you talked to people in China?
No.
Oh.
No, never. I would say maybe there was there was one company in China that is that gets a lot of coverage in the news that we did send letters to that responded more positively than some of the other ones. Mm-hmm. And we did negotiate with them. It was not an easy negotiation, but it resulted in them becoming one of our top five clients in the world. So we went from doing relatively little business with this company to becoming a multi-million dollar a year account for us. We had another company in the same industry. This was one of the cases that ended up in litigation. And we litigated the case in Southern California, the Los Angeles district, and we won a summary judgment against that company. And that was a milestone. That was a life-changing event for me, because it was kind of the capstone of my earlier career with this company based in El Segundo. And that company, we ended up selling that company to National Instruments. It's now part of Cadence Design Systems. But I became so passionate about license compliance based on that litigation we did. You know, the company that we ended, it's public information, so I'm not sharing anything out of context, but it was ZTE. You know, the same ZTE that makes the headlines for selling, you know, technology to Iran, the same company that's been sanctioned repeatedly by the Department of Justice and the Department of State. They were using extensive copies of our software, and we partnered with Kirkland & Ellis, you know, the law firm here in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles office of Kirkland & Ellis, and we successfully achieved a summary judgment against them, and it was a milestone. And then, you know, after the sale of AWR, I left and really wanted to focus on this, on protecting IP. I had learned so much, you know, over the period of time about protecting IP, and I knew that some of these other companies in the semiconductor space, in particular, they were victims as well. There were companies, you know, these companies were being taken advantage of the same way we were. We were a small EDA company, but there were these big EDA companies, you know, that were also, and these big EDA companies, they saw the headlines on that case, and they saw what we did, and they said, why are we not getting serious about license compliance? Why are we not protecting the work product of our employees here in California? Why are we allowing?
So is now let's fast forward to Silent today.
Yeah.
So, you are providing, what I understand is you are providing the alerts, the red flags, the the phone home. Is it still that same kind of operation, that phone home with check out the serial number?
It's light years ahead of where it was when we first came out with it. And it needs to be, because when you're competing with the hackers, the crackers, the pirate groups, these guys are sharp. They stay awake at night the same way we stay awake at night. We stay awake at night trying to figure out how to catch them. They stay awake at night trying to avoid detection. So the technology that we developed, I mean, we first launched, I think, Phone Home in 2002. When we did, we thought it would have a shelf life of about 6 to 12 months before the before the hackers would turn the lights out and figure out a way to disable it. It ended up having a pretty long longevity. But when we started Silent, and originally we were called SmartFlow, that's now our product name. But when we started the company, I co-founded it with one of our valuable partners that was working with us on license compliance, a company called ITCA. So me and the founder of ITCA put our heads together and decided that we were going to develop a new company with technology completely focused on solving this problem. And we would stay 1, 2, 3, 4 steps ahead of the hackers. And that's what we've tried to do at Silent. So we've really evolved the technology. We've made it much more sophisticated, more stealthy, more layers of redundancy, more data points that we can collect. We've really tried to continue to evolve it. And we invest, we invest virtually every nickel that comes into the company into R&D. We have a very large R&D team. We kind of have two headquarters, one here in Los Angeles and another one in Dublin, Ireland. And a lot of the R&D is done in Ireland, and our team over there is very adept at listening to our clients and figuring out ways that the software is being, the copy protection is being circumvented. And then we try to come up with more and more sophisticated ways to try to capture information to identify the bad guys.
So your job is detection and location of the use of pirated intellectual property.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. So now, are the companies that you that are using your technology, are they following the same path to negotiate, to litigate when necessary, to deal with that?
Yes. Yeah, they are. So Cylent, you know, we're not in the business of negotiating the settlements. We're not a services organization. We're a technology company. So what we try to do is to provide the greatest level of information. And we have we're a SaaS company. So our clients log into our SaaS portal and then they bring up a heat map, and that heat map will show them where all the piracy is all over the world. And they can look at the hotspots, they can look at cases, they can look at the data that's coming in. The data is one of the things, the data is just coming in like crazy. So last year we surpassed 1 billion data points. That means 1 billion instances of a person using a counterfeit license, you know, that triggered an event, you know, to our server. This year we're going to surpass 2 billion. So we doubled. It took us 6-7 years to get to 1 billion, and we're getting to 2 billion right away. So that data streams into our portal, and it all lives in the cloud. And then our clients log into this portal, and they bring up all of these fancy graphics that show them, you know, where the hotspots are, where the cases are, who's using what, where, when, and how often. And we aggregate it on an account basis so that they can then have those same kind of wonderful conversations that we had with my previous company, where they can go out there and they can engage with senior management, and they can sit down. Well, these days it's more of a virtual roundtable than actually going out and visiting the clients, but they can sit down, they can present the evidence, and they can say, look, we think we have a problem. We know you're a valuable customer, and we know you've purchased, let's say, 10 licenses, but you're using 25. Mm-hmm. And you need to true up, you know, you need to purchase at least 10 or 15 more licenses to be compliant with the agreement, the contract that we have in place between our two companies. Mm-hmm. And that allows our clients to generate, hundreds of millions of dollars in incremental revenue. So we're working with some of the largest software companies in the world. You know, this piracy rate is about 40% today. So if you recall, I said 6 out of 10. I think it's about 4 out of 10 users today is not properly licensed.
What you're doing is helping companies recover lost revenue.
Correct.
Giving them the tools to recover lost revenue. Where would cybersecurity or hanging on to protecting IP rather than simply, I don't say it lightly, but rather than only recovering revenue, the lost revenue from piracy, how about protecting IP itself?
Okay. Yeah. So this gets into a very interesting area. We have one of our clients out in Boulder, Colorado, that the general manager for the division has said to me, Ted, I don't care if we ever recover a nickel. I'm not in this for revenue recovery. I'm in this for brand protection. And one of the reasons that he's so adamant about brand protection is that the counterfeit software can be a Trojan horse. So when you go to, and in fact, there's actually a pretty good story about this. You know, the you may remember a few years ago, the WannaCry virus that mm-hmm. was blamed on the Russians, but used by the North Koreans. The WannaCry virus doesn't get on your computer automatically. I mean, nobody's going out there looking for the WannaCry virus and saying, I want to install this. So the people who develop the WannaCry virus, the people who develop malware, they need a carrier. Mm-hmm. They need some way of infiltrating these computers. And one of the most fertile grounds that they've found for getting into a network is counterfeit software. Mm-hmm. So what the Russians allegedly did is they looked at what was the accounting software that was most popular in the Ukraine. And they took the WannaCry virus and they embedded it in the accounting software. The company that developed the accounting software had nothing to do with it other than they were the carrier. And that software, because of the economic situation in the Ukraine, you have a high piracy rate. So all of these businesses were installing this accounting software that had the WannaCry virus. And that's how they did it. So when you get down to, I consider us a, not just an anti-piracy company, but I consider Cylent to be a cybersecurity company because what we are doing in effect is trying to shut down that malware channel, which is the cracked software channel. So coming back to our friends in Colorado, you know, they're like, we don't want to be the next accounting software. We know that there's all this pirated versions of our software out there, and we know that we would be a good vehicle for malware. We don't want to have people, you know, that accounting software company, by the way, went out of business because they were the conduit, and everybody, you know, got that off of their software. I'm sure SolarWinds is experiencing quite a backlash.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, SolarWinds became the carrier for this recent rash, right?
Yes. Yeah. And sadly, you know, SolarWinds is, you know, I feel like if they were our client, we might have had a chance of preventing that. Because one of the other things that we do is we have what's called tamper detection technology. And what happened with the SolarWinds attack is that the payload had been tampered with.
Yes.
So what we can do, one of the things that you really want to do is if you're a manufacturer of software, you're the developer, you want to make an image and you want to ship the image and you want it to go out there. And you want to make sure that every single bit is exactly the way it was when it left your test environment. And your
do we still call that the Gold Master?
Yeah, we could call it the Gold Master. So what Cylent does is we can basically ring fence the Gold Master and make sure that not one bit is out of place. And what happens with the way this crack software stuff works is that these evil hackers develop something that they affectionately call the medicine. And and the medicine is a patch. And what that patch does is it goes to the binary and it changes the software and it disables the security mechanism and it makes it so that so that the key licenses that they generate will work with it. So you could install a counterfeit license. So what our software does is it ring fences the Gold Master and it makes sure that the software is exactly the way it should be when it left the manufacturing site. And so tamper detection, that is something. Had SolarWinds been able to make a Gold Master of the updates of the patches that were going out, then that mechanism that was used, you know, to infiltrate it, the client software that was checking the server and trying to get an update, again, it's sort of like digitally signing something.
It's like a Bitcoin. I mean, it's using getting very close to blockchain mentality.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. You want to make sure that you have secured the patch that you're loading and that you're not getting more than you paid for with that update. There's no hidden tricks in the crackerjack box that are going to. You know,
Oh, goodness. Hey, we're getting a whole gigabyte extra here.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So those kind of things do happen with patches. And those are the kind of things that you want to make sure don't happen.
All right. So now this is your, now do you have competition or do you have other companies that are doing similar kinds of things to you with you?
We are fairly unique.
Yeah.
You know, there was one competitor that we had in the market, a company based out in Boston. We were doing a pretty good job of out competing them. They were recently acquired by a company that does the license managing, the license management, the ones that actually produce the keys that are counterfeited. Mm-hmm. So they're now part of a company that's trying to provide, you know, the way we describe it is that the license manager is essentially like the deadbolt that you put on the front door. We don't make deadbolts. We don't make locks. Mm-hmm. What we make is an alarm system so that when somebody either picks the lock on the front door or takes the door off its hinges or breaks a window or tunnels into your, silent alarm. We're the motion detector that lives within your house. What we help you to do is to recover the stolen goods that were taken, you know, when somebody broke in, but we don't do the locks.
All right. So talk to me about what do you think we should be doing as a country to protect our, not necessarily our greatest achievements, but to protect our IP?
Great question. Yeah. So obviously I'm a big advocate of our technology. I believe in defense in depth. So, you know, you need deadbolts, you need security, and you want to do that, but you want to have defense in depth. So you want to have a backup system and you want to have a backup system to that. Shockingly, I mean, you know, I think from what I told you about what we do, you think this would be a no-brainer for a lot of companies, you know, like, why isn't everybody doing it?
Yes.
We shockingly receive a lot of resistance to phone home technology. You know, some clients think that that we're collecting too much data. I certainly am a data privacy advocate. And yeah. I really believe in data privacy, and I'm not a fan of the Googles and the Facebooks. I think are overzealous in collecting data and tracking everything that we do, and I'm not a fan of that. But I am also a proponent of legitimate interest, and if you have a copyrighted application, you have a right to protect it. And if you detect that somebody has not only stolen your copyrighted work, but has tampered with it, you have a right to collect information, including personal data, and the law says you can do this. So you have a legal right. A lot of people go through their end user license agreements and they just kind of click, I agree, and they install it. But you know, when you install an application, a piece of software, you know, you have a contract, you have a contractual basis, and,
yes,
and the user is supposed to abide by the terms and conditions of the license agreement. You know, which means that if it says you can install it on one computer or three computers, you should only install it on one or three, depending upon what the EULA says. But if you install it on 25 computers, there should be a mechanism to alert the manufacturer that it's been over deployed. So
right.
So we're big advocates of that. You know, the same thing is going on. You know, a lot of people talk about SaaS, and in the SaaS world, we also have instances of non-compliant use. We're not as focused on the SaaS market today, but you know, in the SaaS market, people share credentials, and I mean, how I think there's probably only three Netflix accounts out there, and everybody's borrowing the same credentials and logging in. But you see the same thing with software licensing. You know, that people don't necessarily subscribe to the or comply with the named user provisions or some of these things. So I think, you know, we should all be comfortable right now with collecting a certain amount of data. And the benefit of this is that if you're investing in expensive design tools, you want to make sure that the other people that your competition is also paying for them. So part of the price that you pay is that you have to agree to a certain level of monitoring in order to make sure that the playing field is level. And right now the playing field is not level. You know, that was one of the reasons why we did this, was we were concerned that the engineering community in the United States and in Western Europe was at a competitive disadvantage from the engineering community in Beijing and Seoul and Taipei, because these engineers were using counterfeit licenses while people in the United States and Western Europe were paying for the software. So the cost of developing chips and the cost of developing automobiles was higher. We're all about a fair playing field and making sure that people.
Well, should the federal government be doing anything to protect, to help us protect IP, to help build, protect our chip methodology, fabrication?
They should be, and hopefully maybe they will be. You know, we've been talking to key members at the Department of Justice, key members at the Department of Homeland Security. We've spoken, to the FBI. They've actually spoken at our conferences with our customers. The overwhelming message that the government has had for our customer base is that they don't have the resources to protect this stuff. That they that this is something that they want to help, and there have been a few prosecutions. An attorney named David Hall at the U.S. Department of Navy was one of the people who actually brought one of these piracy cases forward, and it was featured on CNN. This case. He also wrote a book called Crack 99 on the subject. It's a really good read on how they were able to get this person running one of these websites that was selling crack software critical for the Department of Defense, these defense applications. They lured this guy out of China. He was arrested, prosecuted, and put in jail. That was one guy, one crack site, and it was almost 10 years ago. There hasn't been a case like it in 10 years. You know, these crack sites, it's a little bit like a game of whack-a-mole. You take one site down and then another one pops up 2 minutes later. And it took a lot of federal resources to prosecute that case and bring them to justice. So, but I do think, that if you read the headlines, the Senate recently, progressed some legislation called the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act of 2021. We're a huge fan of this legislation, a big proponent of it. It is aimed at trying to make sure that we don't lose control of the semiconductor industry to China and to Russia. So it is an effort to step it up. But I think that, the U.S. economy is driven by free enterprise and private companies. I think it's going to take a little bit of a private-public kind of effort to level the playing field. But we definitely need the laws in place to protect IP. And we do need, the FBI and the Department of Justice to step it up when we have instances where these companies are competing unfairly and displacing American jobs. We do need government support, because it is a big expensive problem to solve.
Good.
So
what would now, who is your target market? You said you work with some very large companies, but how small of a companies do you work? What's your target?
Yeah. So that's a good question. Generally, most of our customers are software developers. Typically they're around 30 million in annual revenues or more. But we don't work exclusively with those are kind of like the small to medium sized kind of businesses. We have one company, actually a couple companies that are, two-man operations, $1 million a year in sales. We've changed their lives. We help them. They didn't have the resources to protect their technology. And in one case, a two-man company, we generated $1.2 million in revenue in the first year for them. Our largest clients are, publicly traded multi-billion-dollar-a-year companies, but anything in between. we're interested in talking to. The main things that we look for is we do primarily deal with B2B software, mm-hmm. and we generally deal with applications that are fairly expensive, you know, like a, you know, $1,000, $500 kind of per user kind mm-hmm. of applications. Right. It's not exclusive. You know, some of our clients have lower cost applications, but generally you're not going to, you're not going to go after and pursue, you know, students that are using, you know, we're not in the, for example, you know, the video game market is a very big market here in Southern California. Right. You know, we're not going to go after, you know, students in their dorm rooms for, you know, for using a cracked copy of a, you know, $49 game. That's not our market. Our market is, you know, closer to the $25,000, you know, CAD CAM, you know, tool, where a business is using it and not properly licensed, you know, to use it.
So what, if someone wanted to talk with you, where would they go? What should they do?
Easiest way to get in touch with us is through our website. I'll spell it because it's not spelled. Well, actually it's right here in the background if you're on video, but it's CYLYNT.com. And, you can contact us directly. We are very happy to, we're very happy to do a pre piracy analysis. So let's say you're going to a board meeting and you want to be the smartest guy in the room, and you want to have a custom report that will tell you exactly how much piracy this software product has. We'll do a free report for you. Just go to our website. There's a form you can fill out. Give us the company name, the name of the software application, and your email address. We will scour the dark web. We will turn the internet upside down, and we'll shake it, and we'll try to find whatever evidence we can find to produce a comprehensive report that will tell you what we're seeing in terms of piracy out there. And then you can go, you know, you can go share it with your coworkers, or if you're on the board of directors, you can go share this information with the team and say, is this a problem? Do we want to do something about it? If so, we're here to help.
Excellent. Well, Ted, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. This has been a fascinating journey through this whole world of software piracy and what that, you know, how that affects companies, legitimate companies who are spending money to produce the intellectual property, but then not getting the adequate return on it. So thank you so much.
Will, thank you for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Great. This has just been one more example of businesses and how businesses thrive in California.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.